We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. 2011 has been the deadliest year for tornadoes in the U.S. in more than 50 years. As of the 1st of June, more than 1,400 tornadoes have been reported, and it's been estimated that 525 people have died as a result of these storms. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Grady Dixon. He is Assistant Professor of Meteorology and Climatology at Mississippi State University, and we'll be talking about a number of things. Talk about severe weather generally, could talk a little bit about how tornadoes form and how they are tracked, how it is in recent years we have improved our abilities to make predictions about where storms will form and give people warning. We'll also try to look at some of the factors behind the recent increase in severe weather. So any and all of that, fair game for questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. There's a toll-free, so that's good for anyone. If it would be a long-distance call, use that one. We'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. You can send us an email by writing to will-talk@illinois.edu. Just a little bit more on our guest. He's interested in a couple of big areas. He's interested in things that people do to change their local climate. He's also interested in how variations in weather affect human health and mortality. He's written on a number of things, including relationship between temperature and suicide rates. He's interested in climate effects on wildfire risk, also human response to hurricane evacuations, and generally severe weather climatology. And he's joining us by telephone. And Professor Dixon, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
Maybe first we'll talk about the incidence of tornadoes and also the number of people that have been hurt. And I think we need to separate those two things out because the issues are a little bit different. But certainly it's true that we're now 6 months into the year, and we're probably at the place where there's the peak of tornadoes, although as we know, you can have a tornado, and we have in every month of the year. We're sort of at the peak time, and we could have more, or it could quiet down. How do you figure in what we've had so far, what we see so far, with what we've seen in past years?
That's a great question. I mean, the easy answer is what everybody is probably already aware of, and that's that the month of April was a record breaker in just about every way, every negative way we can imagine. There were exceptional number of tornadoes, an exceptional number of killer tornadoes, and long track and intense tornadoes. But something that people probably are not aware of is that the month of May has been very surprisingly inactive. And with the exception of Joplin, and then another day that had lots of tornadoes that weren't quite as deadly in Oklahoma, the 24th of May, if it weren't for those two events making lots of news, the question would probably be, what happened to May? Did April and May actually reverse this year? Because May is quite below normal in the number of tornadoes and the number of tornado days, and there really is no consistent explanation among researchers that I've heard so far.
And I'm sure that just makes it, that for people like you who are interested in the subject, just makes it that much more puzzling to try to figure out what has happened, and then if you're thinking ahead, what might be likely to happen for the rest of the season.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I get that question quite a bit lately, is what do you project for the rest of 2011? Well, again, the easy answer based on history is, as you mentioned, we're past the peak at this point. Late May is typically the peak. Mm-hmm. With that being said, though, each of the days following May, climatologically, have fewer tornadoes. However, the days that are probabilistically most likely to experience a tornado are in June, so we still should expect several days with tornadoes. Mm-hmm. We should not expect any of the super outbreak type events with dozens of tornado reports like we've had so far this year. But again, we were surprised in April. We expect April to be active every year, but we were certainly surprised with the magnitude. And hopefully none of the forecasters are arrogant enough to think that we can't be surprised again.
Yeah. Well, another, this also shows you that you got to be careful when you're talking about averages, I guess. And
absolutely.
It's certainly true that if you compare the number of people killed just this year with previous years, it's quite significant compared to the 10-year total. However, you also have to consider that that is mostly the result of these of two big outbreaks, the one that swept through the South in late April and then Joplin in May.
That's right.
And there, I think you probably just have to, with the qualification that we're going to talk about warnings and people, how they respond, that in a sense that's just bad luck because we had two very serious outbreaks, but they also happened to strike highly populated areas.
That's right. And really, Joplin was probably the most startling of all because that wasn't an outbreak per se. It was a relatively marginal day. Mm-hmm. I was actually in the plains that day leading a field trip, a storm-chasing class for students. And when we left that morning, I believe we woke up that morning in northern side of Kansas City, and we told the students, after they made their target, and their target was southeastern Kansas, we said, okay, here's probably how this day will shake out if we get on a nice-looking storm. We will follow it to the state line of Missouri or Arkansas, and then we will have to let it go. The road network and the terrain and the trees are not conducive to viewing and education. They're certainly not conducive to safety. So be prepared to let a possibly nice-looking storm go at that point. Well, turns out we did that, except the storm didn't look all that nice. It was quite disorganized and ragged and not photogenic. We weren't really able to show the students anything impressive. And so we did let it go right at the Missouri line. And as we all know, 17 minutes later, after we took our last photos, the Joplin tornado happened. And it was quite a local-scale accident, so to speak. That was the only real strong tornado of the day, and it was very short-lived. I believe the official path on the Joplin storm was only 6 miles, and that has to be one of the shortest EF5 paths in history. So there was a special combination of local effects that occurred. Very unfortunate for those residents, but even more puzzling for the people like me that think we understand tornadoes, because we certainly didn't expect that type of event on that day.
Well, and it's also my understanding that there was something about this that was rare, that this was something called a multi-vortex, meaning, I guess, as I understand it, that you have one big funnel cloud or one big storm area, but what it can do is it can toss off a lot of several smaller tornadoes sort of around the fringe. So
correct.
I guess that would mean that it would be a greater possibility of a lot of serious damage concentrated in a smaller area.
Yeah, multi-vortex has a sensationalist feel to it, and people like to toss it out as being rare. And it is in the sense that strong tornadoes are rare. But typically, if you have a tornado of any significant size, half mile or greater, it will usually have more than one vortex within it spinning around one another. And it's a matter of scale. It's quite possible that even the smallest of tornadoes have many vortices within them, and we're not able to see them or detect them because they're such a small scale. But when you expand everything out, they become more visible. But one interesting thing about that multi-vortex structure is the anecdotal tales of this home was leveled and the next home was spared, and people begin to envision a tornado that was kind of skipping along. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not the case. It's if you have, say, two or three of the most intense winds in these individual vortices, and they're spinning around one another, they're going to create a very irregular pattern of damage. And so you may very well have a squiggly line of damage as opposed to a straight line, and some homes may appear to be spared for that reason.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Grady Dixon. He's assistant professor of meteorology and climatology at Mississippi State University. We're talking about severe weather, particularly the amount of severe weather that we've had so far this year, which is certainly exceeds the average. It's been a particularly deadly year so far, and we're trying to talk a little bit about really what do we know about what's going on and also how people respond when they get warnings. And we'll talk about that too. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller, so we'll go to them. Someone in Indiana on our toll free line. This is line four. Hello.
Hello. Two things. One, sort of a historical thing. I believe it was 1971, about that time it was here in the Midwest where I'm located, close to Purdue University, was what was called the Palm Sunday tornado, which ended up finally in Ohio and did quite a lot of damage. And the thing that was I'm asking about, I lived at that time in a small town. It was on a lake, two lakes, they're artificial. And as a child, I was told, we never have to worry about tornadoes because they never strike near water. And as a small child, I said, well, what is a water spout? You know, and people just look at you like, you don't ask questions like that. I just wanted to know how that one ever got started. And secondly, the more difficult one, perhaps, is connecting this all up with global warming.
Yeah.
What sort of conditions would have to be met where you, as a meteorologist, could say the connection is right here to here to here to here to there, if you can do that sort of thing at all? Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. The global warming or climate change question is quite common. And there's quite a bit of research on how climate change can affect severe weather and even tornadoes. And unfortunately, the answers are contradictory, because if we assume that a warming climate will do exactly that, it will warm the lowest layers of the atmosphere and add more moisture and ultimately make those severe weather days, those really humid, unstable air masses that we associate with severe weather, then perhaps some places that don't experience severe weather will get them more often. But on the other hand, when that happens, when we warm places that aren't typically warm, we weaken our jet stream, that you know, river of air that we talk about so often as meteorologists. And it's basically really strong wind at about 30,000 feet above the surface, and it's created by temperature gradients. And in order to have these gradients, you have to have cold air. And so if we weaken that jet stream, we're not going to create more tornadoes. In fact, we're probably going to have fewer. And so there's kind of two sides of this argument, and we're not sure which force is stronger. If we increase the heat and humidity at a more rapid pace than we weaken the jet stream, then we may very well see more events. But if it happens the other way, we may see fewer. Perhaps we'll see fewer events, but those events could be stronger. That's certainly a plausible hypothesis, but nobody's been able to consistently support that yet. And so I guess the unfortunate answer at this point is that we're not really sure. And whenever we see years like this, we're forced to really question if we're in the process of a change. But you cannot say that we're in a trend with only one event. And if you look at our history, this may be only the second year that could even be comparable to this. And at that point, you have to start questioning whether it was just bad luck. But with a close eye to the next several years and always keeping that in the back of your mind, that maybe there's a trend forming that we don't understand.
Yeah. Anything you could say about the old thing about how tornadoes never go near water?
Yeah, I'm not sure where that has come from before. In fact, this year on that class trip I was speaking of, we saw two tornadoes over water. And sometimes it's said that when a tornado crosses water, it becomes a water spout. Well, you know, the way a tornado forms is consistent, and if it forms over land or over water is not all that relevant in the naming. But there's a different phenomenon called a water spout that occurs typically over warm coastal waters, and it's not the same thing as a Midwestern tornado. But it sounds like the thing that our caller was describing was a traditional tornado that happened to be over the water, and they're just as strong typically. And when they move over land, they can be just as damaging. But there is no evidence or no research that I've ever read that says water will diminish it. The thing that we typically see, though, is that if it's over water, nobody really cares. There's no damage to be reported typically, unless there happens to be ships or docks or something in the way.
Mm. Again, questions about severe weather, how these storms form, how they're tracked. You can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The email is will-talk@illinois.edu. And our guest this morning is Grady Dixon. He is assistant professor of meteorology and climatology at Mississippi State University. This is, I mentioned, or maybe I did mention, that this is has been the deadliest, in terms of fatalities, been the deadliest year since we started keeping records. 53 was also a very bad year. 74 was a very bad year. Explain that by saying, well, unfortunately, that just it happened to be that not only did we have some severe storms, some big storms, but they also hit places where there were a lot of people.
74 is what we've always called the super outbreak, and it was also in April. Remarkably similar to the event this year that stretched from Mississippi and Alabama all the way up through Virginia. And the primary difference between the two events is that actually the storms this year hit more populated areas. The event in 74 was shifted to the north. It was primarily through parts of Illinois, Indiana, and most of the long track tornadoes, I think, affected Indiana. And there's a lot of open space in Indiana, and especially back in 74, the population was not quite as dense as some of the places that were affected this year. So there are some people that still say that 74 outbreak was more intense as far as just the number of strong tornadoes or the total path length or whatever, because we're still essentially assessing the paths of these recent tornadoes. So it's hard to say for sure which one had the greater impact as far as raw tornado numbers. But there's no doubt. I mean, they're so comparable. Those two are closer to one another than any other events in our history. 1953 was a big year, but it did not have any sort of single event that matched what we had this year or in 1974. And there are several years that we can go back, even before our official records, which we say 1950 is the start of our official tornado climate record. But there were a few, what we think were single tornadoes prior to 1950 that killed hundreds of people. Truth be told, if we had the technology to go back and reassess those damage paths, they were probably numerous tornadoes in a history of a storm. But if you didn't have the ability to detect where one tornado stopped and another began, we would just call them one long tornado. And so that's why we often say that we can't really compare events prior to 1950 to the ones that have happened since.
It's another caller here, Bloomington, Illinois, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. All of the fatalities and the injuries and destruction that's so dramatic, I wonder if there's ever a move to require, let's say, in mobile home parks and places that seem to be so vulnerable to large loss of life, safe rooms, to require that if you're going to have a mobile home facility that you have a basement for people to get to, or in new construction to require in areas where there is typically a history of tornadoes. Is there any kind of initiative in that direction?
That's a question I hear a lot, especially among people that are in the storm chase hobby or science field or whatever, people that see these events on a regular basis, and certainly those that research it. So it sounds like a reasonable solution, especially, like you say, to the areas that are most vulnerable, which we typically say are mobile home parks, any clusters of mobile homes. I don't know of any official effort on this front, and I can only guess as to why that would be, and I'm sure it has to do with the politics and the liabilities and everything else. I mean, the one big negative that some researchers have pointed to whenever we start creating these central safe places is what happens when people are en route to these from other locations. For example, let's say I live in a single-family home, but I'm not confident in its strength, and I know that 5 miles down the road there's a mobile home park that has a safe room big enough to house 50 people. Will I then take that risk of outrunning the tornado to make it to that safe room? And are we now just creating bottlenecks where people can cluster and more casualties can occur? That's an awfully negative way to look at it, but that is a conflicting argument that I've heard
Sure.
I recently heard someone suggest that whenever we build new highway overpasses, we put safe rooms inside the mound of dirt underneath the overpasses, because people already, even though they probably shouldn't, are flocking to highway overpasses. They think it's a safe place.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that may help the ones that are already on the way, but in fact, what it'll probably do is encourage others to go there, and again, creating more bottlenecks. So it's a complicated question. I mean, in small
I just know of the one specific example is the fella in Roanoke, Illinois, mm-hmm. a guy named Parsons, who was the owner of a big factory, and he employed several hundred workers, and after the factory was destroyed by a tornado, when he rebuilt, he built a safe room, so that, you know, fortunately there was no loss of life,
right?
But the possibility was so off-putting that you know, he did that, and I think that just shows a real concern for the employee, and you know, whatever. But just I think it's a one way that, you know, you can maybe create a place for vulnerable people to have at least some chance of survival. But thank you for
absolutely.
Your
no, thanks. Yeah, and I agree, especially employers. I think we will start seeing more of that, perhaps even retail outlets. You know, I wouldn't want to name any particular businesses that I'm putting pressure on, but certainly places that have lots of employees and lots of customers may consider that. But I think that's where the research is going to go. I think there will continue to be research on how tornadoes form, but so much of it at this point is making sure that people know how to react when there's a warning and that they have a place that is safe.
Well, this is, I think, a key point and something that I really wanted to talk about. And you can talk about this specifically, or at least make a connection specifically with Joplin, because I think that in the aftermath of the storm, when people who study these things went there and saw how many people were killed, I think they were really shocked and distressed, because they said the people there had plenty of advance warning, more than 20 minutes of warning. And that people living in the Midwest, living in that part of the country, you should be perfectly aware of how damaging these storms can be. And, you know, we tell people over and over again what to do if they're in the path of a storm. So one of the things that you have to wonder is, well, was the death toll really high here because there weren't safe places for people to go? Or maybe they're still, as many times as we've tried to explain it, they're still not sure where the safe place would be.
Yeah, that's a great place. And Joplin, you know, they did have 24, 25 minutes of warning, which is great. I mean, that's probably a perfect amount of time. But the disadvantage that those residents had was that this storm, even though it had been warned for 20-plus minutes, it didn't start producing a tornado of any sort until it was on the edge of the city limits. And, yeah, I can relate, actually, to the people that have heard these warnings before, and, you know, they're going to keep an eye out, but they're probably not going to take immediate action. And that's terrible, because we see what happened. But even more alarming from someone's perspective that studies this is Tuscaloosa. Because the Tuscaloosa outbreak, or, you know, that day's outbreak, was predicted several days in advance. By the time the Tuscaloosa tornado reached that city, it had been on the ground for several minutes. There had been numerous live video feeds of that tornado. There was already news reports of killer tornadoes in Mississippi and other parts of Alabama. Everybody knew at that point that it was an unfortunately unique day, and that there was no day to take things for granted. And all the video that we got out of that event showed the streets were bare. People were taking those warnings seriously, and we still had catastrophic deaths. And that's what really alarmed me, is that I think the people were taking shelter, but unfortunately a lot of the shelters were insufficient.
Let's talk with somebody else. Salem is the next caller. This is line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, I have a couple questions. This morning I saw on CBS they showed that the sun is shooting out enormous solar flares. Wondered if there's anything going on with the sun, because all spring we've had heard scientists talk about solar flares. My other question was, I heard on NPR a couple months ago that a lot of weather changes are happening because the Gulf water is so warm and the Pacific water is cooler because of glacial melt. Is that true or not?
A couple things. The solar flare issue, the sun goes through cycles of intensity, and it's a relatively predictable cycle. It's somewhat regular. And so anytime we start talking about long-term changes in weather and climate, you have to consider what the sun is doing. And so here's the catch-22. Even though we understand the schedule, so to speak, of how the sun's intensity varies, we really don't have a firm grasp on how that variation in intensity relates to changes on the Earth's surface. And that seems so difficult to believe. You know, how can we have all these, you know, satellites and radar and great data and still not get it? But at one scale, it's like a checkbook. You know, you're just keeping track of how much energy is coming in and how much energy is going out. But it's not quite that simple because we only have data points at a relatively select few locations around the planet. There are huge areas that we don't sample that well. And so all of a sudden it becomes like a checkbook that you only find out information about every fifth or sixth transaction. And so it becomes very, very chaotic. So there are some people that have made some pretty strong connections between solar variability and hurricane frequency. But I don't know of any research that's been done with local scale storms or severe weather type tornadoes and thunderstorms.
Okay.
My guess is that will be research that takes place more often in the future. And with respect to the Gulf water, this year, especially in April, the Gulf was abnormally warm. And the Pacific, we were experiencing a La Nina event, which is the opposite of an El Nino. And really all these names mean they're just anecdotal terms for how the Pacific Ocean changes in temperature. During El Nino, it's abnormally warm.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
The different tidal waves, channels of water.
It's a little more than that. I mean, it has to do with global atmospheric pressures and how they kind of oscillate around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And, at some points, water from beneath the surface of the Pacific is welling up to the surface and it becomes cooler. At other points, the ocean essentially sloshes back and pushes that cold water down. And so it's not that we're adding or losing energy. It's just that we're distributing it in different parts of the ocean. And so this year we were leaving a La Nina, which was a relatively cool period for the Pacific. And what that does is it changes the path of that jet stream. And so one of the reasons that the Gulf might have been warmer is that we were under a ridge more often in the spring in the eastern part of the U.S., of course, that certainly wasn't the case whenever the tornado outbreaks occurred. There were enormous troughs passing through and creating those storms. But I guess if nothing else, what you can take away from those two explanations is that there is a whole lot going on. And trying to tie any single event, such as a single year of solar increased activity or a single variable such as Gulf waters, it's going to be muddied very quickly because there are so many things at play when you have to create a tornadic storm.
Well, I want to thank the caller. We have somebody else we'll get to in just a moment. We'll continue to talk with our guest, Grady Dixon from Mississippi State University. We're talking about severe weather and all the tornadoes and the damage that they have caused that we've had this year. We'll talk some more in a moment after a short break. This is Focus.
How are public schools funded in the United States? How should they be funded? School funding is the topic this week on Examining Education. We'll hear from Ralph Martiri on public funding of education, Henry Levin on privatization of schools, and U of I Professor Emeritus Walter McMahon on the economics of education. Join Elizabeth Goldsmith Conley for Examining Education, Saturdays at 6 this month on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the second hour of the program today, we will talk about current events in the Balkans and look back to the wars that were fought in the Balkans in the 90s. Our guest would be Ambassador John Menzies. He's had served as ambassador to Bosnia-Herzegovina. He is now dean of the Whitehead School of Diplomacy and International Relations at Seton Hall University. Tomorrow morning, we'll talk about water, the issue of water around the world. Our guest will be Charles Fishman. He's a journalist and author of a recent book, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Then tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll have another installment of this project we're calling The Deep Archives, something that we've been doing to mark the 30th anniversary of this show, going back and rerunning some interviews that have not been heard in a long time. And these shows, the ones you heard from tomorrow, one is from 1994, the other is from 1999. Anthropologist Mary Catherine Bateson talks about how it is we learn and the need to continue to learn over the course of life. And then Theodore Roszak, a man well known for writing about the counterculture of the 60s, we talked with him back in 1999 about the baby boom generation growing up and what that means for America. So you can hear excerpts from those two interviews tomorrow morning at 11. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. If you'd like to check on the schedule of upcoming shows or listen to past programs, go to our website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour, our guest is Grady Dixon. He is assistant professor of meteorology and climatology at Mississippi State University. He's interested in severe weather climatology and the things that people do to affect their local climate, also the impact of weather on human health. And we're talking about the severe weather that we've seen so far this year. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you want to send us email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have some other callers here, so we'll just get back to the phones and next talk with someone in Philo, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I lived in Indiana in 1974, and I was in those tornadoes you were talking about. I lived in southern Indiana. And the thing that struck me about that whole thing, although I was only 15 years old at the time, so when you're 15, you think you know everything, but the massive disbelief that we all had that we had actually been hit by a tornado was, you know, very apparent. We get a lot of warnings, we get a lot of watches, and nothing ever happens. But this time, something really did happen. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people. They don't really expect it when it happens.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's, and it's very easy after the fact to question how that's possible. But like anyone that has ever lived in a tornado-prone area knows, you get warned quite a bit, and you certainly get complacent. And you know, this goes back too to the idea of putting shelters in public locations. You're still very unlikely to be impacted by a tornado statistically. There are lots of other seemingly outrageous things that you're more likely to be affected by, you know, being struck by lightning or, you know, auto accidents on the freeway. So, yeah, it's certainly human to be complacent in these events. But sometimes, and maybe this is the fault of forecasters and meteorologists, sometimes we have to stress that this event is different than others. In the Joplin case, nobody did that, I don't think, because we didn't expect that type of storm to happen. But certainly on the 1974 outbreak and this year's April outbreaks, we knew bad things were coming, and hopefully we did our best to get that message across in advance.
Well, I was in school at the time, and I remember getting on the bus about 40 minutes or so before the tornado hit, and I looked up in the sky, and it had been raining, you know, for days and days and days. But the sky looked to be clearing. And I said to a friend of mine, oh, I think it's clearing up. And we hadn't heard anything on the radio because we hadn't been around the radio.
Right.
But, you know, that's what happened. We got hit by a, you know, pretty bad tornado at that time. So at any rate, that's what happened.
Well, thanks for the call. Now, I think that the call makes a great point. I mean, I've been guilty of it, too. You know, and as you say, when you grow up in this part of the country, and here on this radio station, when we have watches and we warnings and we broadcast those things, so we hear them all the time. And you hear there's a warning, and then you go outside and you look up and the sky's blue, and you think, well, you know, it's going to go someplace else. That I don't know how it is that you get through to people the fact that yes, at this moment, if you look out things look fine, but there is still this possibility, and you better off take shelter, or know where you can get to shelter in about a minute, because that's how fast things can actually move. And I don't know if there's anything in the way that the people in media talk about this that also could make any difference or not. But it seems like, we have a serious issue. There are several serious issues. One is, do people get warnings? Another is, if they get the warning, do they pay attention? And then the third thing, the thing that we talked about a little earlier, is, well, even if you got the warning and you say to yourself, okay, this is serious, I need to take shelter, where do you go?
That's right. I mean, it's one of those things that our awareness as a general public is getting better. We have so much more information. But, of course, all meteorologists wish that the general public better understood storms. Well, that's probably not feasible. I mean, we can't expect everyone to follow these events with the rigor that we do. And so, the research that I'm working on right now, and that I think will become the type of focus we see a lot more often in disaster research, is we know where tornadoes occur most often. We know where people die most often in tornadoes. And that is, not surprisingly, related to the places that experience more storms. What I'm curious about is, which locations are most vulnerable? A great example, perhaps, is the tornado that went through Raleigh, North Carolina, earlier this year. I think it was an EF3 intensity tornado. It had a relatively long path, but it killed 30-something people, which at the time was amazing. I mean, that would be the story of the year, probably, if not for Tuscaloosa and Joplin. We've had numerous EF3 tornadoes around the country this year, and a few of them have actually hit populated areas with very few and sometimes no fatalities. So why Raleigh? The answer may be something related to the fact that that population is not as accustomed to dealing with tornadoes as maybe places in, say, Alabama or Illinois or Kansas or wherever. And so I think we have some areas that are really at risk, even though they don't get a lot of storms. And we need to identify those places and focus our education and mitigation efforts in those regions.
All right. Let's go to some other callers here. Urbana, line two.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two points to make. One, WILL used to do what they called the tornado show. A meteorologist did it. And it made a believer out of me for two reasons. One, you mentioned, I think, but just west of here, out in the country, there was a factory that had a really great procedure. When they heard this kind of warning, they sent a spotter up to the direction from which the tornado was coming, and when that spotter said, yep, here it comes, they had tornado-safe restrooms for their employees. It destroyed the building. And I don't think anybody got even a scratch. And when I heard that, I thought, being prepared is really the answer. So my point being that if some kind of tornado show went around to schools, probably junior, middle schools, and high schools. And the other part of that show that really made an impression on me is they had a family who didn't pay much attention. I guess one person went to the basement and the other one was kind of dragging her feet. And she got halfway down the stairs and barely made it before their whole house was gone. But that was local. That was in Urbana. And I think, the toss-up is, do you frighten children? Well, maybe yes, enough for them to pay attention. But those two things in that tornado show made me a believer. And the other thing is, I really wish they'd stop the watch, putting a W up on the screen of a TV for a watch, because the W is up all the time, and you just think, oh, well, this is how it is in Illinois.
Well, interesting thought. Go ahead.
That's actually encouraging. I mean, hearing that, this one event seems like maybe years ago had an impact on you personally. And so that is encouraging, because while it's not necessarily systematic across the country, almost all meteorologists, especially those that are on TV, they have a large public outreach component to their job. And certainly those of us in the academic and education fields do the same thing. And so we're on a regular basis talking, typically, as you mentioned, to middle school age children, and sometimes, you know, explaining some important but not very happy details of the dangers of tornadoes to them. And we hope that that sticks with them. But also the point you made, that it probably doesn't unless there's something local. Stories of other states far away probably won't impact them as well as local events.
Right. Well, I'm glad you're doing research in this area, because the death tolls really were appalling.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Thanks for the call. Just to, Professor Dixon, I'm just curious if you have anything to say about the other point. People, again, should be used to the idea that the Weather Service issues watches, and we give them on the station. Other stations do, and sometimes they could be for fairly large geographic areas where we say there is an increased chance of severe storms in and close to the watch area, and these counties are included, and we list them, and we say it goes until this time, and we say, you know, do keep in mind there's a possibility of severe storms, keep aware of changing weather conditions, keep listening to the radio. You know, we have this sort of standard spiel, and it can in fact be the case that there could be a watch for a big area, and, you know, it could be issued at 9 o'clock in the morning and go till 9 o'clock at night. And there, again, I don't know if there's a better way to do it, because if it seems like it's constantly there, or there are long periods of time when it's there, and if wherever you are, fortunately enough, there's no severe weather, then maybe, again, people say, another watch that, you know, they just issue these things and nothing ever happens.
Yeah, that's a big concern of the Weather Service and of researchers and emergency managers. Everybody, you know, would love a way to deal with this. And there's two things that I guess I'd like to say. And the first is, it's not as bad as it used to be, which is, that's still not a glowing endorsement. But at least in this day of constant information, if you were not affected by a severe storm in the watch, you typically hear about the locations that were, especially if you were interested at all. Whereas even 15 years ago, you may not know that a tornado touched down four counties away. So at least you know there was a real threat and that it wasn't a completely false alarm. The other issue is that even when we're only 12 hours away from the event, sometimes the best we can do is a watch area the size of the state of Illinois. And that's unfortunate, and we would certainly love to be better about narrowing that down. But at this stage in the research, that's about as good as we can get that far in advance.
Okay, another caller here, someone in Pontiac, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask if your, and pardon me if I've missed anything that he said on this. I think I've heard the whole program. Just wondering what your expert believes about man-made causes contributing to global warming, and if he does not think that man-made activities are contributing to global warming, then I hope WILL is going to have other experts on that reflect more of the majority of climate scientists.
I don't think that he didn't really say he. There was a question earlier in the program about whether climate change, whether this increase in storms had to do with climate change, and
right.
I think he said we just don't know. I don't, as to the broader point, I don't think we really said anything about that at all.
Okay. Could he answer that then?
Yeah, I'd be happy to address that. As I tell my students all the time, there is no easy answer to that type of question, and usually try to make someone be more explicit in their question. Does man-made activities affect the climate? Sure.
Do you think man-made activities are helping melt the polar ice caps?
Yes, I would say that's a pretty easy yes. But there are also lots of climate change-related questions to which the answer is a murky, we're not certain, or sometimes a flat-out no. So broadly speaking, I'm certainly not an activist or anybody that's going to be screaming that climate change is a hoax or that we need to be implementing wide sweeping policies because of climate change. But I feel like I'm pretty objective.
Don't you think we should have major policy changes about carbon emissions?
Well, that's really a different discussion. I mean, you can say that you need restrictions on carbon emissions for a number of reasons that aren't necessarily related to specifically to any component of climate. But it's certainly a very divisive question. And there, like I said, the easy answer is, yeah, there's no doubt we're affecting the climate. But then the more specific questions become a interesting mix of yes, no, and maybe. And particularly with severe weather, the answer is usually somewhere along the lines of maybe to probably not. But if you go from severe local weather like tornadoes to something like hurricanes, then maybe the answer is closer to a yes. And this type of spectrum, you know, it's not an easy thing to digest whenever you're making broad policy decisions. The question we addressed earlier was with respect to tornado events. And right now the research suggests that a projected climate change that we are expecting based on past trends and potential future impacts of humans should not lead to any more tornado events or more intense tornadoes. But with that being said, we're certainly still researching the area and are not completely closing the book on the question.
I want to thank the caller. We just have about 5 minutes. I have some other, some emails here I want to try to do, and another caller, and we're getting really short on time. Also, for anyone who has just tuned in, I want to very quickly reintroduce the guest. We're talking this morning with Grady Dixon. He is assistant professor of meteorology and climatology at Mississippi State University. I want to try to particularly get in this question because it's the kind of question that whenever we talk about this, we get frequently from people who are trying to figure out where the best place to seek shelter would be. And we have someone here who writes in that they live in a house that's a two-story, fairly open house with a crawl space, and said that up until hearing about the Joplin storm, they had always taken shelter in a closet built under a stairway. And the person who writes says that they felt protected there. However, the pictures of the destruction suggest that might be a false sense of security. All of the bathrooms are next to an outside wall, and they wonder, would they be better off in a car inside an attached garage? And in fact, a friend suggested they should put on their bike helmet while they're sitting there in the car. And it seems to me that this is something we've gotten questions about a lot. Like, well, where is the best place to be? And are you safe if you're in your car, in or out of the garage? I think people are really confused about these things.
Yeah, let me be very, very blunt here. I mean, I just got chills when I heard this person say that maybe they should go get in their car. And that's really discouraging. The answer is absolutely not. There was some research that came out of Kent State University a few years ago, and they suggested that if you lived in a mobile home, you may have a slightly better chance of surviving if you went into your vehicle as opposed to the mobile home. But, I mean, we were really splitting hairs here over two terrible places to be. The answer is if you are in a conventional house, whether it's a conventional foundation or a slab foundation, you are presumed to be much safer in that building than you would in a mobile home or an automobile. And I understand the concern. The photos from Joplin are terrifying. However, I saw quite a number of structures that had at least one closet or room at least semi-intact, and a lot of the survivors told those stories. You know, there was some really dramatic video of some people that took shelter in the storage room of a convenience store. That was the most interior room, and that was the place that survived the storm. So the easiest answer is put as much material, be it walls or mattresses or helmets, as she suggested. You know, put these between yourself and the outside. And by getting into a car, you reduce that, even if you're in a garage. You know, glass is certainly not going to help. And the doors of a vehicle can be pierced quite easily with flying debris.
And that's, I guess, the point that we try to make again and again is the thing that's what kills people is flying debris. And the most that you can do to protect yourself from that, there you're going to at least increase your chances of surviving the experience. Well, we have at least one more caller here we want to get. And again, we're very short on time. We'll go over to Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello and good morning. I've listened to most of your show, not all, and I don't know if we missed this particular point, and it's something that's very, very unique to tornadoes, and people I don't think really understand it, and that's the aspect that they're very serendipitous. I personally was very close to a tornado just east of Champaign driving down the interstate. It just happened to go across in front of me, blew up a barn. I watched the whole thing. Very scary. And you see in these pictures, too, that they'll go in an area, and 20 feet away from total destruction is something that's standing pretty much pristine. And that's a strange aspect of tornadoes that people don't really understand.
Yeah, and they are severely localized. I mean, just by their general shape and size, they are going to have a very distinct path typically. And sometimes it's even more confusing than that. Sometimes we have these large tornadoes that are a mile wide, and like we did mention earlier about multi-vortex tornadoes that can seemingly skip storms in the middle because the vortices are kind of dancing around one another. And then other times, you know, I equate it to if you're using a blower to clean off your sidewalk, you know, sometimes there's that leaf that just won't move, and it's the fluid dynamics involved that somehow will pin that thing to the ground instead of blowing it away. And that certainly happens in these storms when they're interacting with trees and structures and everything else. Mm. So you're right. It sometimes can be intriguing and terrifying all at the same time.
We just have about a minute. One thing we can certainly say is that folks like you who do this kind of work and the meteorological community and the Weather Service have gotten better at making predictions on where storms will occur. And then through some technical means, and probably the big thing is the Doppler radar, you can actually give people much better warning about tornadoes. Do you think we've done about as good as we can, or do you think that there will be enhancements that will allow you to give a more precise kind of warning?
Technology is going to help us. We are currently developing and getting ready to implement better radar across the country, and also our computer and modeling abilities are getting better. You can make an argument that our understanding of the tornado dynamics maybe has reached a bit of a flat spot, but I don't think that's going to limit our improvements in warnings, and I certainly think studying people and their reactions is probably going to have the best impact on mitigating damage in the future.
All right. Well, our guest, Grady Dixon, is Assistant Professor of Meteorology and Climatology at Mississippi State University. And Professor Dixon, hey, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. I enjoyed it.